America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Richard Viguerie is with us. He is the author of a new book, Conservatives Betrayed, How George W. Bush and Other Big Government Republicans Hijacked the Conservative Cause. The website for the book, conservativesbetrayed.com, perhaps better known as one of the primary architects of the modern conservative movement and the many successes that conservatives and Republicans associated with conservatives have had over the last 25, 30 years. Richard Viguerie, welcome to the program.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Thank you for being here with us. I'm curious, you know, first of all, you've come out against the war in Iraq as being an anti-conservative thing, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just not, you know, what conservatives are about. I became a conservative in the world. I was born a conservative, I think. But anyway, I certainly was beginning to articulate and get involved in politics in the late 50s. And our number one issue back in those days was communism, because the Soviet Union was, you know, a mortal threat to our very survival. And it was appropriate to deal with the Soviet Union. But Iraq was not a mortal threat to our survival. Ronald Reagan won the Cold War by bankrupting the Soviet Union. This president, President Bush, is going to lose the war and maybe bankrupt America in the process. Exactly opposite of what Ronald Reagan did. Ronald Reagan won the Cold War with no planes flying, no tanks rolling, no armies marching, no shots being fired. And he prevailed. He said, yeah, we were going to go over, around, under. We were going to transcend communism. This president,
some of us just, you know, to put a fine point on it, but I don't want to get in a debate with you, frankly, about this. But the CIA had been predicting the fall of the Soviet Union for 15 years before Reagan came into office. A, and it fell on Jerry Ford's administration. B, so you know, Reagan gets
not. You don't mean Jerry Ford. You meant George Bush, huh?
No. Oh, it's a George. Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. Yes, it was the father. Yes, I'm.
but
you're right.
But
the ravages of age here. you're absolutely right. Yeah, it was Bush Senior when the Soviet Union actually fell. So you know, if you want to try and give credit, but I understand your point. We never bothered to invade the Soviet Union. We did it smart, not stupid. And Bush seems to be doing it stupid, not smart. Or you know, not to put words in your mouth, but that would be how I'd say it. But here's the thing that I'm curious about, and this is why I've been looking forward to this conversation with you, because we have. You and I, or let's say conservatives and liberals, have a fundamentally different view of the role of government in the United States. And this is a debate that has been going on literally since Alexander Hamilton and John Adams on the one side and Jefferson and Madison on the other side were debating these things. I mean, you know, one of the first pieces of legislation in the Jefferson administration was to provide the federal government to provide what today would be called welfare, to provide for widows and orphans living in Washington, D.C. In fact, James Madison, when it came back around when he became president, vetoed it because it was being distributed through a church, and he said that was wrong. It should be simply secular. Not something that John Adams agreed with, you know, the conservative.
Sure.
So here we are, 230 years later, and, you know, you're absolutely right that conservatives, for example, have not been interventionists. Conservatives opposed the entry into World War I, the entry into World War II. Conservatives in 1935 fought strongly against protection for labor, the Wagner Act and the National Labor Relations Act. In 1936, fought strongly against Social Security. George W. Bush in 1977 campaigned for the House of Representatives on almost a sole platform of privatizing Social Security. Conservatives fought in 1947 with the Taft-Hartley Act to roll back protections on labor, to try, you know, trying to undo the Wagner Act. How do you move forward with an agenda that is essentially undoing the New Deal? You know, rolling back Social Security, getting rid of Medicare, getting rid of the Department of Education. How do you do those things when they are so patently popular with the American people?
Tom, as you say, not to put too fine a point here, in the short time we have together here, I don't want to, you know, point by point disagree with what you said there. I mean, we are not.
Oh, feel free.
We are not dismantling Social Security. We're trying to save it. Social Security is going to bankrupt America, and everybody, Republicans and Democrats, know we have a massive, perfect storm coming here. Where we've got to do something with that.
But your point is that you think, and feel free to interrupt me too. I think your point is that you think it's better handled by the private sector than the public sector, right?
Well, I think you have to have a mixture of both. We're not talking about privatizing Social Security. We're trying to save it because we're going to have a situation soon where 80 to 90% of all of the gross national product of this country is going to have to go for entitlements. I mean, something's got to give here. And the Democrats are playing politics, and they're trying to use it to defeat the Republicans. Republicans are trying to figure out how do we save Social Security. But anyway, be that as it may, you're exactly right. At the fault line between a Republican, not a Republican, because who knows what they are these days, but between the left and the right is the role of government in our life. And as a general rule, Democrats believe that government is usually the best way to solve those problems, and as a general rule, conservatives feel the best way to solve most problems is through the private sector, through the individual initiative, responsibility, etc. And we've gotten a situation, Tom, where the Republicans' leadership in Washington and much of the state has moved your way towards the Democrats. They feel that bigger government is better. And so conservatives, and that's why the New York Times ran their poll last week, Time Magazine has Reagan with a tear in his eye this week, talking about conservatives are very, very unhappy. We've lost our way because we became an appendage of the Republican Party. We became an arm of the Republican Party. And until conservatives pull back and focus on their agenda and not the Republican agenda, we're going to continue to wander in the wilderness and not get to the political promised land.
Well, and what would the political promised land look like for you, Richard?
Well, it would be a government that, for the most part, Tom, leaves people alone. We had a wonderful economy back in the 90s, and, you know, we were everybody was happy with the
but government was
economy.
In everybody's lives in the 90s.
But what we had was we had
by your definitions.
We had a Democratic president and a Republican.
No, but we had Medicare, we had Social Security, we had a Department of Education, we had welfare programs. I mean, these are all things you want to change.
Massively. Because of the Republicans. I mean, Clinton didn't want to cut back welfare. The Democrats didn't want to cut it back. The Republicans insisted that we reduce the role of welfare in our life. And it's worked for everybody's benefit, including the people on welfare. They are better off today. They have real jobs instead of...
Well, we have actually more poverty now than we did then.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but no, I don't believe very many people would agree that people are better off on welfare than they are in the private sector. So, anyway, Tom,
as a way of life, no, I would agree with you, but as a backstop for all of us. But again, I don't, you know, we can debate these issues. I don't think there's much point in it because we're acknowledging our differences. I'm just what I'm curious about is how do you as conservatives go about, and this, frankly, on the progressive side, you know, we're having the same debate. How do we as progressives, you know, take control of the Democratic Party or get, you know, our agenda, you know, through the Democratic Party that is contaminated by conservatives the same way you've got a Republican Party that is contaminated by what you would probably describe as liberals. How do you do that? What is your strategy going forward, Richard Fieger?
Well, you know, I think that, answer, I guess, 12 different ways. My strategy going forward, Tom, would be to urge conservatives, and I do it in my book, Conservatives Betrayed, talk about third force, not third party, third force, that we need to get out there and stop being an appendage of the Republican Party, focus on our own issues, our own organizations, and pull everybody our way. Pull the Republicans our way. Pull the Democrats. The
independents. Isn't that what happened in 64, though, and with Goldwater, and it melted you down?
No. We were just beginning that. In 1980, under Ronald Reagan, his two elections for president in 80 and 84, he carried 42 states and 49 states.
Well, he talked the talk, but he didn't walk the walk.
Each time.
No, I understand, but, you know, Reagan talked the talk, but he didn't walk the walk. He grew government faster than any president in history. He borrowed more money than all. Yeah. Say that again?
People were voting for his talk in 1980, and he carried 42 states there. And,
right, but he didn't do it. Yeah. I think if he had done it, people would have turned on him.
No, hardly. The Democrats are running away from liberal issues. What Democrat ran in this last election for higher taxes, for same-sex marriage? Name them. They're just not out there, Tom. People are conservative at their core. They don't.
I think there are a lot of Democrats who
don't like liberalism. And if they liked it, why do Democrats call themselves progressive instead of liberals? And why do they run from their issues?
Dwight Eisenhower made the point that we're out of time here. You make a good point, though. We will, and I look forward to it. Richard Viguerie, his book, Conservatives Betrayed, conservativesbetrayed.com, the website. Richard, thank you for being with us today.
Pleasure, Tom. Bye.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Of living's bound to keep on going up and up as we begin to dip in Social Security's broken cup. Healthcare costs are rocketing way too high to fall, and it seems most folks in Washington don't give a damn at all.
I don't think so. I'm sorry. I'm going to disagree with my own damn bumper music. 22 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dwight Eisenhower once said that there are, and I'm paraphrasing. In fact, I was looking for the quote here as I was during the break, but I couldn't quickly and easily find it. He made the comment that there were people in the Republican Party who thought that they, you know, who wanted to do away with Social Security and who wanted to do away with protections for labor in the United States, the conservatives. And he said basically that if those people thought that they could win an election, that they could or for that matter should pursue those kind of policies, they were crazy, that they never again win an election. And that was the, I think, kind of the money line from Eisenhower, that they would never, the Republican Party would never again win an election if they did that. And that's the problem, frankly, in my opinion, that conservatives are facing. And what's interesting is Time Magazine, Richard Viguerie mentioned Time Magazine, this cover story with Ronald Reagan with a tear in his eye on it, How the Right Went Wrong, by Karen Tumulty. And, you know, reading this article, I am struck by the startling rewriting of history and repositioning of conservatism. It rather boggles my mind. For example, Karen writes, these are gloomy and uncertain days for conservatives who, except for the 8-year Clinton interregnum, have dominated political power and thought in this country since Reagan rode in from the West. Well, first of all, arguably not. You know, as Richard Viguerie points out, Reagan did not govern as a conservative. Bush Sr. did not govern as a conservative. Clinton arguably was, you know, moving in more conservative directions. I mean, he, you know, WTO, GATT, NAFTA, doing away with welfare. I mean, there was, you saw a lot of conservative things happening. Reagan wasn't trying to privatize Social Security. He wasn't trying to do away. I mean, he gave lip service to doing away with the Department of Education, but he didn't try and do it. Then she goes on to say, and this is where it gets even weirder, their tradition goes back even further to founding fathers who believed that people should do things for themselves and shook off a monarchy in their conviction that big government is more to be feared than encouraged. Well, the founding fathers believed people should do things for themselves. See, this is what we shook off was the British East India Company and tyranny. We replaced monarchy with democracy. The founding fathers were liberals, not conservatives. The conservatives in 1776 were those who said, no, don't go to war with England. And they were pretty outspoken about it. So to say that the founding fathers who were radical progressives, you know, Tom Paine, who said, you know, who outlined the social security system, who argued in favor of labor, who said that, you know, we should have a national minimum wage program, who argued in favor of progressive taxation, Thomas Jefferson, who argued in favor of an estate tax. To call these people conservatives is bizarre. These were the children of the Enlightenment. They were the children of Rousseau and Locke, the thinking of Rousseau and Locke. They were the original liberals. As George Washington said, I hope to see America ever at the forefront of liberality. And then she goes on, Karen Tumulty, in How the Right Went Wrong, the cover story in Time magazine, to say the Boston Tea Party, as Reagan used to point out, was an anti-tax initiative. I'm sorry it wasn't. It was the other way around. I mean, please, Karen, go back and read history. In 1773, the British East India Company had all this extra tea in their warehouses in England that they couldn't sell in the United States. And there was an economic recession going on in England. And so they petitioned the British government to lower the tax on their tea and increase the anti-smuggling laws into the United States to increase their monopoly on tea in the colonies. Now, you had small businessmen up and down the East Coast who were bringing tea in from Holland to the Dutch trading companies, from India. They had all these small ships that were coming in and all these small entrepreneurs. And the Tea Act of 1773, which was a massive tax cut for the largest corporation in the world, the British East India Company, would have put all these entrepreneurs out of business. And that's why you had the Boston Tea Party. It was an act of violence against a multinational corporation. It was a $1 million act of vandalism. It was the first Seattle WTO protest. It's what created this country. This country was created, the revolution was created, on an opposition to a multinational corporation. Far more, frankly, than opposition to the king. Earlier in 1773, Jefferson had written about how we should be loyal to the king. It was the Boston Tea Party that changed his mind. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where smart people get their news. It's interesting in today's, I believe it's the New York Times. Is it? Yeah, here it is right here, New York Times. Paul Krugman, Don't Cry for Reagan. A very timely piece, March 19th, 2007. He's essentially saying, Reagan never left us. George Bush is what Reagan would have been if he'd had a Republican Congress. He's doing what Reagan wanted done. It's just that Reagan couldn't do it. He had Republicans in power who had some sense about them, and he had Democrats in control of one or the other House of Congress throughout his presidency. So, you know, gee, I mean, this is the end point of crony capitalism. When you consider, you know, Reagan's famous, he loved to make jokes. He once made the comment that there are no good people in government. If they were any good, they would have been hired away by private industry. Not realizing that, you know, arguably that applied to himself and everybody in his cabinet. He also said famously,
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And, you know, set about making sure that that was the case, thus Katrina. And, you know, as Paul Krugman points out, you know, this is the whole ideology of government can't do anything with regard to the public sector is Bush writ large. Bush is Reagan with the Republican Congress. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Rick in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. The Vigory guy, he just had on, he's spewing so many myths. Correct me, or tell me. Let me ask you a question. Which country doesn't have a social safety net for its common man that is economically successful?
Yeah, well, there aren't any.
So how can he come on and not be challenged? He said that Social Security is bankrupt.
Well, I have these debates with conservatives almost every day, and I've debated Social Security to death and everything else. And I'm assuming that my listeners all know my positions on these things, and that's why rather than getting into a food fight with him about the individual particulars of the conservative agenda, I thought since he is one of the guys who over the last 30 years is most responsible for bringing us Reagan, Bush Sr., and Bush Jr., that it would be interesting to find out, you know, what his strategy is, what his thoughts are for the future. That's what I was really curious about.
I think it's chaos.
Yeah, well, it seems like
it's
it.
It's gotta be chaos because there is no evidence. I mean, you said something to him. He said he begged to differ. It's like you're talking about one and one equaling two, and he's arguing something else as if it could come up some other answer.
No, I know.
There's no evidence.
Exactly. No, well said, Rick. And you look at countries that do have strong social safety nets, and they're doing very well, thank you very much. Germany and Japan probably right at the top of that list. John in Hayward, and thanks for the call. John in Hayward, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
I guess the comments are kind of along the same line. The Vigory person, the conservative you just had on, when he got to the part about saying how conservatives want to save Social Security,
said, they want to save it for Citibank.
I just about lost it, and I've got to thinking, how can they even say something like that? Obviously, our problem is that the power division between conservatives and Democrats has shifted so vastly that the conservatives pretty much own the media, so they can just say anything. They can say George Bush is Jesus Christ tomorrow, and most of the media would go along with it.
Well, there are a few people who probably believe that, but John, you know, you're spot on, and what you're pointing out is that here's the problem. I believe when Richard Vigory says he doesn't want to destroy Social Security, he wants to save it. And, you know, I frankly expected him to be a little more candid, as, you know, very often our conservative guests will be about, you know, what they actually mean by that. But, you know, nonetheless, that he wants to save it. That by saving it, if that means putting it all in the hands of Charles Schwab and getting the government out of the business of social safety nets and all that kind of thing, that's their reality, and that's the problem that we as a country face, is that there are people who, deep down in their hearts, probably fundamentally decent people, actually believe this to be true and dedicate their lives to making it happen. And then when they bring it about, what does it do? It destroys a country.
Yeah, except that I don't really, there probably are a few, but fundamentally, I think that we just have to stop playing nice with these people and say, what are you for eugenics? Because basically what they're saying is we want to start killing off the old and whatnot. Because as they've stated for a long time, they want to do away with Social Security and our safety net. So basically, if they want to start talking about maybe world overpopulation, then half the world's population is in China and India alone. So don't start killing us.
Just
stop being nice. Well, I'm not talking saying you, but we as Democrats should just stop playing nice and just take the clothes off of these guys.
It is time to wake up to the real issues. Well said, John. Thank you very much. It is time for us to recognize the real issues and to recognize the real ideology that's at work here. And you know, be upfront about it and challenge it straight on, as Paul Krugman did brilliantly today in the New York Times. And on the other hand, you know, it's time for conservatives to get honest about what they're about. I am so tired of hearing Republicans say, oh, you know, we're really not, you know, trying to do away with Social Security. We just want to, you know, save it by, you know, giving it to the big investment companies. You know, there are some, no doubt in my mind, there are some Republican politicians who don't believe that the best thing for this country would be to privatize Social Security, but they're promoting it anyway because they're getting huge campaign contributions from the financial sector. However, I think that probably most of them are ones who just don't understand, and they're getting huge contributions from the banking industry and the investment industry. And so, you know, off they go, you know. Abraham, in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Abraham, welcome to the program.
Hi, Don. Thank you very much. I noticed the guy, the conservative, brought up about that we don't like to call ourselves liberals, but progressives.
Well, I call myself a liberal all the time.
Absolutely. No, and I do too. But they like to throw that in there because they want to have the discussion of liberal versus conservative, not progressive versus regressive.
Well, that's an interesting one. Although I would say that conservative, that they have succeeded in reinventing the meaning of the word conservative over the years. I mean, you go back, and it was the conservatives who argued against the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. It was the conservative Alexander Hamilton who, in his opening speech to the Constitutional Convention in 1787, said that the president should be elected for life, that we should, in essence, have a king in this country, but it should be a meritocracy rather than a genetic lineage. That was his only difference. He said that there's never been a greater form of government created than that of the United Kingdom. I mean, you know, that's the bottom line.
But from a naming standpoint, they hate to be called regressives.
Yeah, okay.
Anybody would.
Sure, progressives and regressives.
This is like a very nice way of putting it in perspective, of progressives and regressives.
Yeah, very interesting. Thanks, Abraham. Carl in Sierra Foothills, California, listening on KFPT. Hey, Carl.
Hey, how are you? I have
I
a
am
rebuttal
great.
For some of Mr. Vigory's statements.
Sure.
He mentioned that no Democrat ran on a platform of higher taxes or gay marriage.
Right.
Well,
I almost interrupted him at that point, but then I thought, you know, I'll let him get to his point because it's just so obvious. You know.
Yeah. I don't think we believe in higher taxes. I think we believe in fair and more equitable taxes.
Exactly. And in actually paying as we go. I mean, the reality is that George Bush did not cut taxes, period. He did not cut taxes at all. What he did is he shifted taxes from the shoulder of today's millionaires and billionaires onto the shoulders of tomorrow's middle class. That's what George Bush did. He borrowed money to reduce taxes on the very, very wealthy, and that money is still going to have to be paid. Those are still tax dollars that are going to have to be collected. They're simply going to have to be collected in the future, and it's the exact same thing Ronald Reagan did. And frankly, I suspect that Richard Vigory would agree with me that that's not a conservative thing to do. But, you know, the partisans among the Republicans, you know, certainly don't want to talk about that, and so...
I was raised by conservatives, but Ronald Reagan cured me of that.
Yeah, so was I. Carl, thanks a lot for the call.
And also on the gay marriage issue, I don't think a Democrat can run on that necessarily because, as far as I'm concerned, it's a non-issue. If you don't want to get married, that's fine. If you do want to get married, that's fine. And it's hard to make a non-issue a plank in your platform.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. In fact, last Friday we had a debate with a guy who kept talking about the homosexual agenda. Well, first of all, the reason that they like to use that word is because it has the word sexual in it. I should have said to him, oh, you are a practicing heterosexual, hey? But in any case, I got an email from Stephen, one of our listeners, and because I asked the guy, you know, he was all, you know, down on the homosexual agenda, and I said, what is the homosexual agenda? And he, like, really didn't have an answer. So Stephen sends me an email, and Carl, you're going to love this, and thanks for the call, by the way. The homosexual agenda, 6 a.m., go to gym. 8 a.m., breakfast, oatmeal and egg whites. 9 a.m., hair appointment. 10 a.m., shopping. Noon, brunch. 2 p.m., number one, assume complete control of the U.S. federal, state, and local governments, as well as all other national governments. 2, recruit all straight youngsters to our debauched lifestyle. 3, destroy all healthy heterosexual marriages. 2:30, beauty rest to prevent facial wrinkles from stress of world conquest. 4 p.m., cocktails. 6 p.m., light dinner, soup, salad with Chardonnay. 8 p.m., theater. 11 p.m., bed de jour. That's just great. Stephen, thank you so much. Finally, we know what the homosexual agenda is. And you got to look out for those wrinkles. Oh, my. 45 minutes past the hour. Today is the anniversary. We're starting the fifth year, the fourth anniversary of the war in Iraq. I also want to revisit some of the things that Bush had to say that got us into this war. We got a whole lot to do today. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
is led into another senseless war. How many thousands must lay dead before we wake up from this nightmare and revive the American dream? If we blindly stay the course, this horse will drown us in the stream. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrow's will depend on what we do today. Don't stay the course on a horse that's going the wrong way.
And man, this horse is definitely going the wrong way.
Bush trying to justify his war in his little speech this morning. Today, the beginning of the fifth year of our ongoing occupation of Iraq. The quote, by the way, David tracked this thing down for me during the break. Thanks to David Poole, my producer here. On November 8th, 1954, President Dwight D. Eisenhower said, and I quote, "Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs?" Now, keep in mind, those were the four major accomplishments of the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt. Again, back to Dwight Eisenhower, now that I've pointed that out, we'll just restate this. Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our political history. There is a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes that you can do these things. Among them are a few Texas oil millionaires and an occasional politician or businessman from other areas. Their number is negligible, and they are stupid.
Roosevelt is dead! His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah. This is where, you know, this Time magazine cover story is just so wrong. I mean, it's just incredible. It's like they're reinventing conservatism. They're reinventing Reagan. They're reinventing history. And, I think it's tragic. I think, we need to just say it like it is, as Paul Krugman did in today's New York Times. George W. Bush, with a Republican Congress, is doing what Reagan would have done if he had had a Republican Congress, but he didn't, and so he couldn't. Very simple. Dan in San Diego, California. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Well, not much. I wanted to talk about who ended the Cold War, but I felt I had to comment on the quote that if people in government were any good, they'd be hired away by industry. And,
right.
You know, they're the same people. I mean, you know, you got to keep an eye on both of them. You know, is there much difference between Ken Lay and Tom DeLay, except that one of them is dead, you know?
Yeah, well, good question. A good point, yeah.
And anyway, onto the Cold War. It's one of my pet peeves because I get sick of all the ignorant simpletons going like, oh, Reagan ended the Cold War, and they ignore history. I mean, communism ran for 70 years. The Cold War ran for 50 years. And communism, you know, it's not a viable
communism
system.
Yeah, communism ended the Cold War by imploding.
Yeah. And
it's just that simple. Yeah. And the CIA had been predicting it since the Eisenhower administration.
Yeah. And you look at all the other things, you know, we did. You know, there was the Marshall Plan, Berlin Airlift, Korea, Radio Free Europe, NATO, the space race, the arms race, Cuban Missile Crisis, Vietnam. You had the Solidarity Movement. You had dissidents like Sakharov and Solzhenitsyn. You had Glasnost. You had the Afghan War, then, you know, it all capped off with the old guard dying off. Recall you had Andropov, Chernenko, and Brezhnev all died in like about a two-year span. And you got that long list, and you got all these guys like, oh, Reagan spent them into the ground. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, no, it's nonsense. It's a justification for handing $1 trillion to Reagan's good buddies, the defense contractors, who Don Rumsfeld was lobbying for when he was tapped by Bush Jr. to become defense secretary. But that's about it. Yeah, good point, Dan. Thank you very much for making it. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Rich.
Hi, Tom. I thought I was listening to Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire there for a minute. just a quick comment and a question. One of the things your guest said that he said that most Americans are conservative at heart. Well, you know, if you look at the main viable candidate for the Republican Party, he's socially liberal on gay rights and abortion.
Rudy Giuliani, he's running for both for president and first lady at the same time.
So socially conservative.
Rudy Giuliani is the only candidate among the Republicans and the Democrats who has appeared on television in drag.
That's exactly right. And there is a
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right. Their choice is they can stick by their principles and risk losing the election, or they can stand by their principles and vote for somebody outside.
Yeah. Vote for Sam Brownback or something. And actually, that's what I saw at CPAC, you know, that 2 days that I broadcast this program from the Conservative Political Action Conference, which really was birthed by Reagan. I mean, it existed for a few years before Reagan, but his speech to CPAC in, what, I think it must have been 80, no, what year would it have been? 80, well, whatever it was. One of the early years there, you know, one of his first years, was really the beginning movement of that thing. And everybody was running around talking about Reagan. Nobody was talking about Bush. Nobody wanted to talk about Bush.
You're right. And Tom, could you give us a status report on the subject and when your next book will be coming out? Thanks, Blake.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call, Rich. My next book is going to be called Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Communication. And we're hoping it'll be coming out this fall. I was spent about 20 hours this weekend working on the thing, step by step by step. Nick in Martinez, California, how is the anti-war march where you live?
Well, my wife and I went in, and it felt like a big crowd to me, I'll tell you that. And
is it in San Francisco?
We walked up Market Street all the way from the Ferry Building up to Civic Center, which is a mile.
Yeah, it was
plus,
huge here in Portland. They were, you know, the, you know, what I'm hearing from all over the country is that a lot of people came out and you know, people are standing up and speaking out. This war is not popular.
All kinds of people, and we kept looking for a counter demonstrator. That whole way we didn't see one, and we walked it going up and we walked it going back, not a single counter demonstrator.
You know, that's really what has vanished in the last year and a half, 2 years, because it used to be 2 years ago that there were always the counter demonstrators out there, and you're right, you know, and I didn't see that here. It's or any evidence of it, any reporting about it. It's interesting that the go ahead.
I went on the internet to get somebody else's estimate of the crowd, because I had it at least 20,000, maybe more.
Yeah.
I read a Chronicle report on the internet that said 3,000.
Oh, geez. Well, you know, there's nothing new about that, Nick. Everybody's, you know, hyper-conservative when it comes to crowd estimates, particularly anti-war crowd estimates. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll hear from George Bush about why we should have a war right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And welcome back. Of course, the entire Joe Wilson, Valerie Plame meltdown for the Bush administration, what's going on right now, right up through and including the Fox Republican noise machine over the weekend, Brit Hume basically making up reality. All of this goes back to those magic words in the President's State of the Union address in January of 2003, just a few months before he invaded Iraq. Now, you will recall at that time, Bush was still saying that he was not going to invade Iraq at a news conference. Right around that time.
He said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Yeah, yeah. But this is what he said at the State of the Union. Now, the State of the Union addresses tend to be very solemn, very formal occasions, and the president tends to speak very slowly and have long pauses. And so the one modification that I've made to this is unedited in terms of content. But we have gone through and taken out the long pauses between words and phrases. So it sounds like Bush is talking a little faster, not Donald Duck faster, but, you know, there's not as much because there's a lot of content here. There's not as much empty space as was in the original speech. But here's Bush speaking, George W. Bush, in 2003, a few months before the invasion, telling America why we should be afraid.
The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. Our intelligence sources tell us that he has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes suitable for nuclear weapons production. So
now, you know, what's interesting about all of these things is, first of all, we know now that Bush knew that the uranium from Africa was a lie. That when Berlusconi came over and gave him the documents, the CIA had already looked at them. Bush handed them to the CIA. They said, nah, it's phony. They had to launder them through the British government. And so Bush knew that this was a lie. Secondly, the aluminum tubes. They knew that the aluminum tubes were the wrong thickness for centrifuge tubes, that they were rocket tubes. We now know that they knew that. These are blatant lies. He continues.
Saddam Hussein has not credibly explained these activities. He clearly has much to hide. The dictator of Iraq is not disarming. To the contrary, he is deceiving. From intelligence sources, we know, for instance, that thousands of Iraqi security personnel are at work hiding documents and materials from the UN inspectors.
Now, it turns out that was just the exact opposite, as Hans Blix kept saying, we're having pretty good access here to everything.
Sanitizing inspection sites and monitoring the inspectors themselves. Iraqi officials accompany the inspectors in order to intimidate witnesses. Iraq is blocking U-2 surveillance flights requested by the United Nations. Iraqi intelligence officers are posing as the scientists inspectors are supposed to interview. Real scientists have been coached by Iraqi officials on what to say.
Supposed to? Officials? Well, in any case, you get the point. I mean, he's making a case for war. Over and over and over again. Again, this is months before the invasion, when Bush is still claiming that he hasn't decided what he's going to do, although it is 6 months after the British memo was written, the Downing Street memo, that said that they were going to make the case for war because the war had already been decided, that they were going to fix the intelligence to meet the policy. And this is what he's doing. What he's laying out here is cherry-picked intelligence via Doug Feith, via the Office of Special Plans, Paul Wolfowitz, these guys just, and Dick Cheney, obviously, the cherry-picked intelligence that arguably was not intelligence. And as the CIA was saying, no, wait a minute, we got nothing to do. We don't agree with that. The CIA got spanked. They got punished. They got whacked upside the head by having one of their own outed. And frankly, I am of the opinion that outing Valerie Plame had as much to do with telling the CIA, keep your mouth shut, as it had to do with punishing Joe Wilson for pointing out the lie that started this quote here.
Intelligence sources indicate that Saddam Hussein has ordered that scientists who cooperate with UN inspectors in disarming Iraq will be killed along with their families. Year after year, Saddam Hussein has gone to elaborate lengths, spent enormous sums, taken great risks to build and keep weapons of mass destruction. But why? The only possible explanation, the only possible use he could have for those weapons is to dominate, intimidate, or attack.
Or he doesn't have them, and he didn't have them, and he did get rid of them, and Scott Ritter supervised the destruction of them and came back and told us, there's nothing there, there's no there there. We got rid of all those things. And then, and the few that we weren't sure of, Bill Clinton went in and bombed the sites, blew them to smithereens. And then during the no-fly zone era, I mean, we took out his entire Air Force. Everything was gone.
Nuclear arms or a full arsenal of chemical and biological weapons, Saddam Hussein could resume his ambitions of conquest in the Middle East and create deadly havoc in that region. And this
is called projection, where you attribute the motives of yourself to others, in my opinion.
Congress and the American people must recognize another threat. Evidence from intelligence sources, secret communications, and statements by people now in custody reveal that Saddam Hussein aids and protects terrorists, including members of Al-Qaeda.
Oh, yeah. Now, another one that we found was known at the time to be a lie, that the CIA was loudly telling the Bush administration, Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda hate each other. Hate each other. Although Osama bin Laden was being treated in a hospital in, was it Dubai? The UAE? Kuwait? I forget where it was. It's, one of our ally countries for a while, Osama bin Laden. But Saddam Hussein would have had nothing to do with him. Because for the simple reason, he didn't want anybody to challenge his own power.
Secretly and without fingerprints, he could provide one of his hidden weapons to terrorists or help them develop their own.
In other words, we are at risk, therefore we are justified in attacking.
For September the 11th, many in the world believed that Saddam Hussein could be contained.
You notice there, before September 11th, many in the world believed Saddam Hussein could be contained? And you wonder why so many of our troops over there think that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, why so many Americans think that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, when in fact he had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11?
Chemical agents, lethal viruses, and shadowy terrorist networks are not easily contained. Imagine those 19 hijackers with other weapons and other plans this time armed by Saddam Hussein. Take one vial, one canister, one crate, slip into this country to bring a day of horror like none we have ever known.
So, you know, Saddam Hussein, those 19 hijackers, 9/11, Saddam Hussein. Is there a pattern here?
Do everything in our power to make sure that that day never comes.
Yeah. The big applause line. So, and we will do everything in our power to make sure that that day never comes. I mean, this was Bush laying out the case for war. I mean, very simply, very, very simply. He
perceived chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons even while inspectors were in his country. Nothing to date has restrained him from his pursuit of these weapons. Not economic sanctions, not isolation from the civilized world, not even cruise missile strikes on his military facilities.
Now, keep in mind, this was the State of the Union address. When this is the only speech that the Constitution requires the president to give. Actually, it doesn't require him that he give it as a speech. Thomas Jefferson submitted it in handwritten form. He was not a very particularly good public speaker. But it's the only report to the American people that's required by the Constitution. This is a constitutional duty. Arguably, this is a statement under oath. And the president swears an oath not to defend the American people, but to defend the Constitution. By lying?
Almost 3 months ago, the United Nations Security Council gave Saddam Hussein his final chance to disarm. He has shown instead utter contempt for the United Nations.
Yeah, well, and that, you know, frankly, was not the case. And when Hans Blix tried to point that out, you know, hey, you know, this is, you know, you guys are like looking for witches, you know?
You know, in the Middle Ages, when people were convinced they were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence.
Yeah, we'd like to have some real evidence. We didn't find any, by the way. I mean, when Hans Blix went before the UN and said, you know, just give us a couple more weeks. We're getting full cooperation. We can go anywhere we want. We're not being supervised. We don't have people traveling around with us. I think within a few weeks we'll have this thing figured out. That was the point at which Bush said, okay, we're going to war now in violation of Resolution 1440. In violation of it, because Resolution 1440 said there had to be a Security Council vote before there could be an invasion of Iraq. And 6 months after the invasion, we went back and had the UN retroactively give us permission. Strange stuff. So here we are on the fourth anniversary, starting the fifth year. What's next? 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call
866-303-2270. There's a price for freedom and a price for truth, and money doesn't bleed red, white, and blue.
Welcome back to the radio support group on by and for we the people of the United States of America, because freedom's still our home. I'm in 21 minutes past the hour. Joe Wilson, about 2 years ago.
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frogmarched out of the White House in handcuffs.
Now, what that was all about was that State of the Union address that you were just hearing, where Bush says, we've learned from British intelligence that Saddam's been trying to get uranium from or has acquired uranium from Niger, from Africa. No. And you knew that that wasn't the case. And Joe Wilson has the temerity, the audacity to say, no, ain't the case. It's amazing. It's just amazing. This whole series of extraordinary deceptions that are starting to come unraveled, that are starting to basically disintegrate. David Iglesias, the prosecutor in New Mexico, who got bounced, who got on the hit list after Heather Wilson and Pete Domenici called and basically tried to get him, to influence him, to prosecute Democrats before an election. And he's on Fox News this Sunday just laying it out.
Performance has nothing to do with this. This is a political hit. And I just wish the Justice Department...
No, by Justice Department, he means Alberto Gonzalez.
...would have been honest when it testified in January that these were, in fact, not performance-related, but, in fact, political. I think it's incredibly telling that I wasn't on any list, any hit list, until just weeks after those two very inappropriate phone calls from two members of Congress.
There you go, David Iglesias. Just pretty straightforward stuff. I mean, this Chuck Schumer talking about this.
But in these instances, the evidence is becoming more and more overwhelming that certain U.S. attorneys, and only certain ones, not all of them, but certain U.S. attorneys were fired because either they wouldn't prosecute a case that was politically advantageous to the White House, or they were prosecuting a case that was disadvantageous to the White House. Every legal commentator, left, right, center, says, you can't do that. That's the one thing you can't do.
Yeah, well said, Chuck Schumer. And now we're getting down to this whole, larger thing that it looks like. I mean, this McClatchy reports from thinkprogress.org. Fired San Diego U.S. Attorney Carol Lamb notified the Justice Department that she intended to execute search warrants on a high-ranking CIA official as part of a corruption probe the day before a Justice Department official sent an email that said Lamb needed to be fired. This is what U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein said Sunday on television. She said the timing of the email suggested that Lamb's dismissal may be connected to the corruption probe. Yeah. And also, I mean, there's an L.A. Times piece out this weekend, or out today, actually, I believe it is, suggesting that actually the thing that's connecting all of this, if you want to, connect dots to dots. Well, here it is. This is from today's Los Angeles Times. Democrats turning up heat on firing of U.S. attorney. Senate Democrats signaled Sunday that of the 8 federal prosecutors abruptly ousted by the Bush administration, the case in San Diego is emerging as the most troubling because of new allegations that U.S. Attorney Carol C. Lamb was fired in an attempt to shut down investigations into Republican politicians in Southern California. That would be Jerry Lewis at the very least. And this, Dianne Feinstein talking about this on Face the Nation. So, here we have this series of, what pulls all this together, from the State of the Union to the outing of Valerie Plame to the firing of the federal attorneys, is that it all, the entire web goes back to this collection of lies that were organized and orchestrated, that were pulled together and put together out of the White House and the Pentagon by this small cabal of people who wanted us to have a war in Iraq. And we did. And we George had his successful war, and when he stood on the aircraft carrier and said, the war is over, he was right.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
And there's no longer war going on. What's going on now is an occupation. And so we had, 3 months, 2 months, month and a half, I mean, depending on how you define it, of war. We had a successful war. It was an illegal war, but it was a successful war. We conquered another country, took their institutions, took their political institutions, took control of their land, absolute control. And now we've had 4 years of an incompetent occupation of that country. And frankly, the ongoing and subsequent destruction of that country to a large part. And people are out in the streets today, the anniversary. People will be out in the streets today as well. There's going to be a big protest here in Portland, Oregon. There's protests all over the country honoring or protesting, frankly, this ongoing occupation of Iraq. We'll be back with your calls after this. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Back, Tom Hartman here with you. The place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Our number 866-303-2270. Drop by our live chat room at tomhartman.com if you want to say hello. And Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado, listening on WDTW. You must be listening on the stream, Ralph. Hey, what's up?
Yeah, first-time listener, so I'm a little bit discombobulated. Basically, according to Victoria Plame's testimony last week, didn't the Bush administration assist terrorists to acquire, develop, or possess weapons of mass destruction?
Yes, she said that Brewster Jennings, the front company, a CIA front company that she was the director of, was in the process of investigating weapons of mass destruction activities that had to do with Iraq, specifically.
Bingo. Okay.
Yeah, and there's a substantial subset of conspiracy theorists out there who believe that one of the reasons why Brewster Jennings was brought down when it was brought down was because they had just successfully intercepted a weapons of mass destruction, a shipment of weapons of mass destruction that was heading through Turkey for Iraq that would then be conveniently found by our forces to justify the invasion. And, you know, it's a nice theory. I've seen no evidence to support it, but there's a number of folks out there waving that particular bloody
Okay, well, let me just add something in here from the legal perspective. There are four statutes, to my knowledge, basically that cover, that give lifetime sentences for anyone who assists terrorists to, and again, the wording is possess, acquire, transfer, or develop WMD.
Right.
Now, the requirement basically is that it be a knowing assistance. And for the life of me, I can't believe that people as intelligent as Karl Rove or Scooter or Dick or whoever the hell it was that decided to blast Plame out in the open and blast Brewster Jennings out in the open didn't know that doing so is going to have two effects. One is every source we have is instantly toast.
Right.
If they're not dead, or how right. shall I say, acid bath by Saddam.
Yeah, and or other countries as well. I mean, let's assume that Jennings' activities were not just limited to Iraq.
Oh yeah, but people know about Saddam's; they don't know about some of the other people's.
Sure.
The second thing is the effect of that is anyone who is ever thinking of being a human intelligence source for the United States is going to instantly give up that idea and go out in their garden and dig. So what happens is you've got, number one, Brewster Jennings eliminated. Number two, if there's anything else that Plame is associated with, that's also eliminated. Number three, you got all of the potential sources that might tell us where WMDs are. They're not going to come in. So now Bush...
Plus, you've got the CIA intimidated at the time when the CIA is in the midst of a power structure with the Defense Department and the Office of Special Plans.
Yeah, but see, the thing about it is you don't need to go with the DOD in order to, how shall I say, indict for WMD crimes.
Right.
And
I'm just talking about the political realities of it, not the legal realities.
I quite agree with you. I hadn't thought about that angle, but that makes perfect sense, too.
Because the CIA had been saying all along, we're not sure that there's anything here.
Well, but you know,
Bob Woodward's book notwithstanding, the only evidence that contradicts that is Bob Woodward, where in his book he said that George Tenet said it was a slam dunk. And I, you know, I'm that's not enough for me, that one quote.
Well,
even, you know, so.
And I'll tell you also on what's come out with the firings of the attorney generals. I have a great deal of respect for Patrick Ferguson. Fitzgerald, excuse me.
Fitzgerald, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing about it, he's a very brave man, a very good prosecutor. But the way you shut somebody like Fitzgerald off from prosecuting or expanding the prosecution to anti-WMD crimes is you basically say that's classified.
Yeah, and that's what Bush did.
No, but they didn't do it. Fitzgerald hasn't said that. And I hope the hell Congress starts looking at the limitations that were put on Fitzgerald's investigation with regard to classified information.
Yeah, well, they are. And that's the good news in this story, Ralph, is that the House and the Senate for the first time in 5 years are actually conducting oversight. And it's amazing. I mean, they've only been in power a couple of months. And look at all the rocks that they've overturned. I mean, you know, imagine a year from now. It's mind-boggling how this is not going to lead to such obvious high crimes and misdemeanors that impeachment is the obvious thing is frankly beyond me. Ralph, I've got to move along. I appreciate the call. It's good to hear from you. Raj in Manhattan. Hey, Raj, welcome to the program.
What a great show, Tom. Long-time listener, first-time caller in your show. I really appreciate what you're doing. What I need to make a point out of it is that our president, whom we call president, elector or selected, what you call, is a compulsive, pathetic liar. I'm like, Tom, isn't he under oath?
Yeah, well, arguably. He is under the oath of office. Whether that means...
When you take the office of presidency, don't you take the oath to regulate the Constitution and strictly abide by the Constitution?
Yes, to uphold, to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States.
And that isn't an illegal binding for him to tell the truth, but not nothing else?
Well, that's something that is arguable. And, you know, it's...
You are holding the position
although,
of the
although, although, frankly, I mean, you know, Nixon tried this.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
And basically Congress said, oh, yeah?
but you could show the middle finger to the Constitution, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have to obey it.
Yeah.
That means
yeah.
You have to obey it, isn't it?
I get your point, Raj. And if Bush knowingly lied, and the evidence is, I think, fairly overwhelming that he did, and certainly other members of his administration who were feeding him this information knew that it was inaccurate.
The second point,
have they committed a crime by lying to the American people?
Absolutely.
And I would say, if not a legal crime, certainly a political crime.
Tom, as we have the power right now as Democrats, why we are not proceeding all these things? Why we are not impeaching this guy?
Well, they are. I would submit to you, Raj, that they are. That you can't. That the impeachment of Richard Nixon didn't come about because they said, okay, let's hold a hearing and impeach this guy. The impeachment of Richard Nixon came about because they held a hearing and they said, what's the deal with Watergate? Let's start digging into this. And they dug about halfway down into it, got up to their hips in it, and said, looked around and said, holy cow, look at this swamp. And then it became an impeachment hearing.
It's not about, like, you know, we all hate Bush or we don't like Bush. It's about the rule of law, you know?
Right, exactly. And that's what Congress is doing right now, Raj. I salute them for it. And I appreciate your call, by the way. But I think it's just, I think this is the beginning of a process that is not going to end. Liddell in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Liddell, what's up?
Hi.
Am I pronouncing it right, Liddell?
Liddell, yeah.
What's up?
First, that can you hear me? Because my phone has gone crazy here.
No, I can hear you. It's a little faint, but Alex can pot it up there in New York. What's up?
Well, I'll be quick. I just want to say that I really, really love hearing you guys. I only discovered you a couple of weeks ago, and I emailed everybody, and they said, "Oh, sure, we love them. We've been listening." So,
thank you.
The first thing I want to say is that it's so comical that we don't even pay any attention to the fact. We completely overlook the fact that poor Bush can't even say nuclear. He says nuclear, and we don't even pay any attention to it. His stupidity is so,
I think that there's a certain danger in that, Liddell, because there is a difference between being inarticulate and being stupid. And there are a lot of are very articulate people of modest intelligence, and there are some very, very bright people who are inarticulate. I'm not willing to believe that George Bush is stupid. I believe that he may be, you know, he might test low in some areas, particularly those that have to do with the use of the English language and certain types of emotional intelligence. But I suspect that there is frankly, a brilliance there that has to do with his ability to interact with people at a certain level. I don't quite know how to define it, but, you know, there are some people, you know, Howard Gardner's idea of the seven intelligences, you know, that his interpersonal intelligence skills are very, very high, and they've gotten him in large part to where he is.
This is why I listen to you. It's so interesting. More or less sociopathic. That kind of brilliance.
Yeah, I would, if somebody pushed me and said, do a diagnosis, I would say narcissistic personality disorder, which, you know, is a mild form of sociopathy. Yeah, no, I'm not disagreeing. Liddell, I got to move along. I appreciate the call, though. 1-866-303-2270. Matt in Brentwood, California. Hey, Matt, we got a minute before we got to take a break. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to pose the idea that we should be focusing, that maybe on the fact that Valerie Plame may have been the principal interest of the Bush administration, and that her husband was, in a sense, used as an opportunity to silence her and the CIA internally and keep information from being able to, you know, be released.
Right. That's the conspiracy theory that I referenced earlier, and I don't mean that in a way of putting it down. Simply that it's only a theory
either.
Right now, because there's no evidence to back it up. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I mean, this is all in the world of the CIA, of classified stuff. But that the outing of Valerie Plame really was an effort to shut down and quiet the CIA, not to punish Joe Wilson.
Right.
And
right.
Joe Wilson, if anything, was a convenient excuse.
Right, it happened to work to their advantage to have both things happen, that publicly and privately, internally, they could silence everybody, and then there would be no evidence left that was, you know, that they couldn't somehow manage.
Well, it might have even been reverse engineered. It might have been that they were sitting around for weeks going, Brewster Jennings, the CIA, these guys are going to point, these guys are on the verge. I mean, they just shut down our effort to smuggle, you know, WMD into Iraq so that our troops could find them, so that we could go on Fox News and say, see, here it is. I mean, we've got to do something about this Brewster Jennings. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Oh, Joe Wilson's wife. Hey, let's go after Joe Wilson. And that way, you know, et cetera. I mean, it's possible that everybody's looking at this from the wrong end of the telescope. Who knows? 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 9 minutes before the hour. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, listening for the advertisements on your local affiliates so that you can support the sponsors who make this program possible. And they do need to hear from you. As well as our national sponsors like SacredGroundsCoffee.com, SmallDog.com, Small Dog Electronics, the Organic Wine Company, 1-888 Eco Wine, and Purina One Natural Blends at 866-380-Meow. 9 minutes before the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you'd like to drop by our live chat room, TomHartman.com. There's a blog over at AirAmerica.com. And Bob in Thousand Oaks, California. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Oh, hey, Tom. How you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I just want to first compliment you on educating this country as to what's really going on in the world. I only wish you could be on television also to counteract the Sean Hannity's and Bill O'Reilly's of the world. I think that would be
I'm an old radio rat, Bob. I'm going to stay with radio. This is as high as my aspirations go. I'm having a great time doing it.
Whatever. You're doing wonderful. Just one quick question on something that I've never heard it explained, and maybe it has been, but regarding the outing of Valerie Plame, regardless of who said who said what to whom, whether it was Scooter Libby or Cheney or anybody else in the administration, what I don't understand is supposedly the actual, you know, saying of who she was and what she was doing was told to Robert Novak, who wrote a column on it. What I don't understand is how come Robert Novak has not also been indicted for this. I mean, he's the guy that made it public.
Yeah, and Bob, in your confusion about that, I share your confusion about that. I don't know why he hasn't been indicted either. And that is what I thought Patrick Fitzgerald was originally charged with finding out. And
I would have thought so.
Although arguably, you know, I do have some information on this. The law which apparently was broken, which is the outing of a CIA agent, requires certain types, very specific types of knowledge and very specific types of intent. And odds are Novak did not have that knowledge or that intent. The people who fed him the information, however, probably did. I'm sorry, I don't have the law here in front of me. We did a program on this about a year ago, and I could have quoted, you know, chapter and verse from it, but I don't have it right here in front of me right now. But good chance that Karl Rove actually did break that law and did break it big time. So anyhow, that's
spend some time in the slammer along with the rest of them that did it.
Yeah, that's you know, Joe Wilson's little boy, wouldn't it be nice, you know?
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs.
So there you go. That's Joe Wilson's take on it. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Tiffany in Sparks, Maryland. Hey, Tiffany, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, speaking of massive deceptions coming unraveled, I wonder where we'd be if we still had real elections. And,
we would have had Al Gore as president to begin with if our elections were paid attention to. I mean, the New York Times reported that a year after the fact, when they actually counted the vote, that no matter how, you know, in Florida, that whether it was dimpled Chad, pimpled Chads, pregnant Chads, hanging Chads, dangling Chads, intent of voter, undervotes, overvotes, by any measure, Al Gore got more votes in Florida than George W. Bush did. And they buried that fact in the 17th paragraph in the article. Why? Because the article came out 1 month after 9/11 and in the New York Times. And the editors later said that they didn't want to undermine the legitimacy of George Bush when the country was under attack.
Well, I have a Clint Curtis update. It's very interesting, but I would like to ask listeners to get a paper and a pen.
Well, let me just first, you know, and while they're doing that, let me tell people who Clint Curtis is. Clint Curtis is the guy who was working for a software company down in Florida and the company was approached, according to Clint Curtis's sworn testimony. I'm reporting this as his testimony, not as mine. Clint Curtis was approached by Tom Feeney, who was then the Speaker of the House of Representatives in the state of Florida. He was the guy who had said that even if Gore got more votes than Bush, if the count actually happened the way the state Supreme Court said it should, that the state legislature would send their electoral votes for Bush anyway to Washington, D.C., which they have the legal authority to do, by the way.
Right.
So Tom Feeney, according to Clint Curtis, approached Curtis's company and asked for Clint Curtis to write software that would allow him to hack voting machines so that Republicans could steal elections, or so that elections could be stolen.
Yes.
And Curtis assumed that this was, you know, so that Feeney could figure out how to prevent elections from being stolen. He wrote the software. Feeney took possession of the software, according to Curtis, and that was the last we heard of it until in this last election. Curtis actually ran against Feeney in the election and, you know, trying to get this story out.
Right.
Feeney is now the congressman, the federal congressman from that district in Florida, rather than the state legislator from that district. So,
yes.
Background. Okay, we've got about 40 seconds here, by the way, before we have to wrap up this hour. So,
Clint Curtis has been walking for democracy with volunteers, and what they're doing is collecting signed affidavits from voters stating who they voted for. This is hard data evidence. And what we're finding out is, like, for example, in Precinct 66 in Seminole County, the official results showed 55% of the vote for Clint, and it's more like 80. So now what we have to do is compare ballots to the evidence, and we need to do discovery for that.
So you're saying, Tiffany, that apparently the Feeney-Curtis election was stolen by Feeney?
Yes.
And you need money for that. Is there a website?
We need money for discovery, and yes, there is. It's www.clintcurtis.com.
Mm-hmm.
Please go there and give whatever you can, because the bills are rolling in and discovery is about to happen, and we need your help.
ClintCurtis.com. Clint's been on this program several times over the last 4 years. He's a great guy, and if his testimony is true, this is a really, really dark day for democracy. Tiffany, thanks for the heads up.
Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome, and I hope folks get over there and check it out at ClintCurtis.com. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with
you. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And welcome back, my friends, to the third hour of our program, 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here on this Monday, whatever the date is today. My computer's not mousing over. What? What is the date? The 19th of March. Thank you, Alex. And time now for the next episode in our ongoing saga of the liberal shadow.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The liberal shadow knows.
Yes! And in this episode of the liberal shadow, we have a Cheney alert!
You don't know the power of the dark side.
Yes, our official Cheney alert theme music there, or whatever you call that. This from the Center for American Progress, Think Progress blog, thinkprogress.org, just breaking news. Now, just consider this timeline. This goes back to, by the way, Carol Lamb, the U.S. attorney, also known as a federal prosecutor in California, who put Duke Cunningham in jail. Now, let's go back and look at what she put Duke Cunningham in jail for. One of the things she put him into jail for was living on a yacht called the Dukester, D-U-K-E-S-T-I-R, living on a yacht worth $140,000 that had been paid for by a fellow by the name of Mitchell Wade, who was a defense contractor. Now, in addition to the yacht, Wade apparently gave Cunningham as much as $1 million, maybe more than $1 million in bribes. So Cunningham and the Dukester, excuse me, Cunningham and Mitchell Wade, the defense contractor, and Duke Cunningham, the congressman, show up at a yacht selling establishment, whatever you call it. You know, it's a marina. And they say, you know, let's look at this boat. This is August 30th, 2002. Now, oddly, now just remember that date, August 30th, 2002. Okay. For $140,000, they buy a boat. They look at the boat. Duke Cunningham, the congressman, loves the boat. And the next day, well, not even that. Here's what a guy, you know, one party to the sale, right? This is presumably the boat salesman, right, or the yacht salesman. He says, I knew then that somebody was going to go to jail for that. Duke looked at the boat, and Wade bought it all in one day. Then they got on the boat and floated away. Okay, there's $140,000 cash for a yacht. 2 weeks earlier. Now, that's what Duke Cunningham went to jail for, in part. 2 weeks, and keep in mind, $140,000 for the yacht at the end of August in 2002. 2 weeks earlier. Exactly $140,000 was given to this same guy, Mitchell Wade, to provide office furniture and computers for Vice President Dick Cheney. Yes, you heard it right. Vice President Dick Cheney. So here's the order of events. August 15th, Dick Cheney gives Wade $140,000. 2 weeks later, Wade uses $140,000 exactly to buy a yacht for Duke Cunningham. 2 years later, Carol Lamb finds out about it and throws Duke Cunningham in jail. And I don't know the prosecutorial status of Mitchell Wade, but, he pled guilty. Throws them both in jail. Are you seeing a possible sequence of events here, a possible connection? Could it be that the reason Carol Lamb was fired is because she was looking into the vice president's involvement in this? I mean, this is how the Center for American Progress lays it out over at thinkprogress.org. You can go there, read it yourself. Great blog. Was Carol Lamb targeting the White House prior to her firing? That's the headline. Referring to the Bush administration's purge of former San Diego-based U.S. Attorney Carol Lamb, Senator Arlen Specter said recently. Now, keep in mind, Arlen Specter is the Republican who was the head of the Judiciary Committee, under whose name was slipped into the Patriot Act a few months ago. This provision that says that during time of national emergency or war, the president can fire federal prosecutors and replace them without their having to be confirmed by the Senate. Because if they had to be confirmed by the Senate, then the Senate would say, okay, well, you know, this nice person, this new person you're putting in is just very nice, but why is the old person being fired, right? They didn't want that oversight. And Specter, I mean, remember back, you know, a year or two ago, Specter was going through this whole cancer treatment thing. He was losing his hair. He was going through chemotherapy. He was having a hard time. I mean, chemotherapy is hell. I have several friends who've been through it. And at the same time that he was questioning the administration on a number of things. And so the administration comes to him, the White House comes to him and says, you know, if you want any support from us in the next election, you're going to have to prove that you're on our side. You're going to have to hire one of our right-wing hacks to work for you. And Arlen Specter said, okay, give me the guy and I'll put him on my staff. I mean, obviously, this isn't the language they used, but this was the effect. And the guy that the White House said, you've got to put this guy on your staff, that guy was the guy who inserted into the Patriot Act after it had been voted on by the House, after it had been voted on by the Senate, when it was in conference committee, before it went to the president, so that none of the senators and nobody in the House of Representatives knew about it. Even Arlen Specter himself didn't know about it, but because it was his staffer, it could be done under his name, inserted into the Patriot Act this provision that allowed the president to fire federal prosecutors and replace them with new people without their being confirmed by the Senate. Arlen Specter gets up on the Senate floor recently and says Carol Lamb was let go because she was, and I'm quoting Arlen Specter now, quote, about to investigate other people who were politically powerful, end of quote. Back to the Think Progress report. The media reports this morning that among Lamb's politically powerful targets were former CIA official Kyle Dusty Fago and then House Appropriations Committee Chairman Jerry Lewis, Republican from California. But there is evidence to believe that the White House may also have been on Lamb's target list. Here are the connections. Washington, D.C. defense contractor Mitchell Wade pled guilty last February to paying then-California Representative Randy Duke Cunningham more than $1 million in bribes. Wade's company, MZM Inc., received its first federal contract from the White House. The contract, which ran from July 15 to August 15, 2002, stipulated that Wade be paid $140,000 to, quote, provide office furniture and computers for Vice President Dick Cheney. 2 weeks later, on August 30, 2002, Wade purchased a yacht for $140,000 for Duke Cunningham. The boat's name was later changed to the Dukester. Said one party to the sale, I knew then that somebody was going to jail for that. Duke looked at the boat, and Wade bought it all in one day. Then they got on the boat and floated away. According to Cunningham's sentencing memorandum, the purchase price of the boat had been negotiated earlier that summer around the same time the White House contract was signed. To recap, the White House awarded a one-month, $140,000 contract to a criminal contractor who had never held a federal contract. 2 weeks after he got paid, that same contractor used a cashier's check for exactly that same amount to buy a boat for an imprisoned congressman at a price that had been pre-negotiated. Was Carol Lamb about to investigate Dick Cheney? Why am I hearing Spiro Agnew's voice in my head?
These nattery knobs of negativism, yes.
16 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
6 years we've been under a curse. It ain't getting better, it's worse and worse. Me and the president, we don't agree. Now the NSA's got a file on me. I've got those blues, Republican blues.
Ah, those Republican blues. This weekend, Louise and I went to see, along with one of our kids, one of our daughters and her husband, we went to see the movie The Lives of Others. And, by the way, welcome back 21 minutes past the hour. The Lives of Others is an amazing movie. It takes place in East Berlin. And it takes, I believe it takes place in 1984. It ends, well, actually, I don't want to tell you how it ends. But it starts because you want to see this movie. This is an incredible movie. And it's at the tail end of where, you know, playing where it might be playing. It's still here in Portland, but, you know, probably not for more than another week or so. Odds are the same is true where you live. And it's about the Stasi, the German secret police. And 2 years later, 2 years after 84, when the first part of the movie takes place, my family and I, Louise and I and our three kids, we lived in Germany, in West Germany. And I remember one day, our oldest, who was then 14, I think, and I, we went to the zoo, the entire family, all five of us went to the zoo. And Louise and the two younger kids, they just wanted to go look at the animals and things. And our oldest and I said, you know, hey, let's go to East Berlin. That seems like more fun. So we hopped on the train and went over to Checkpoint Charlie and went into East Berlin. And it was kind of a gray, rainy day. And we stood there for, I don't know, a half hour or so waiting for a taxi. And finally, this kid pulled up, in his early 20s, I'd say, pulled up driving a private car and asked us if we wanted a gypsy cab, basically. And we said, sure. you know, give us a tour of East Berlin. We've got, you know, 4 or 5 hours while the rest of the family's at the zoo on the other side of the wall, and we'd like to see the place. And now, the story that I had been telling myself for all these years, from 86 until now, what is this, 21 years, was that it was exactly what I thought it was, what it looked like. This kid's name was Toasten. He I don't remember his last name. And he said, if we get stopped by the Stasi, we have to have a story. And so let's make up a story right now. We'll just say that that we're related. You're my cousins from America. And so I need to have some information about you so that if we get stopped, our story will all make sense. Now, interestingly, he never told us anything about himself. But he wanted to know, where I was born and where I was from and what I did for a living and my daughter's name and the rest of my family's name and, our other two kids and my parents' names and where they were from we spent probably a half hour of him just pumping me for information, and I'm just, here it is. And, thinking, this is, man. And then he was, during the 4 or 5 hours that we were in East Berlin, traveling around, and we went over to a restaurant, and waited 40 minutes to get served and all that kind of stuff. It was an interesting insight into East Berlin at that time. And this was 86. This was 3 years before the wall came down. In fact, I was in Budapest, Hungary, the day that the wall came down, or the entire week that the wall came down, with my friend Jerry Schneiderman from New York, my best friend for 30 years. And, it was an interesting bookend. But in any case, so this movie... And the reason I'm going off on this rant is because the bumper music got me started on this. Now the NSA's got a file on me. Well, now I looking back on it, after I see this movie, The Lives of Others, which is about the Stasi, I realized, Toasten was a Stasi guy, and he was pumping us for information to see if we were spies and to see who we wanted to see in East Berlin. He was probably waiting for me to say, hey, by the way, just drop me off at this corner for a few minutes. I got to run into this apartment. And then he would have gone, aha! Right? And then, of course, that never happened. But A, the Stasi has probably got a file on me, and those files are now publicly available. But B, it's a real hit of what is it like to live in a country. And as I've mentioned here on the air before, I mean, I was in Russia when I was in the Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union. I was in Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union, and worked in Russia briefly after the fall of the Soviet Union. Been back in Kaliningrad in that area. And we've been to Moscow a number of times. And our oldest daughter spent a year in the Ukraine, almost a year, studying Ukrainian and Russian. This is the one who went with me into East Berlin. At the old spy school where Carlos the Jackal trained, they turned it into a language school after the wall fell, or after the Soviet Union imploded, to try and make some money. And she was a language major in college. But it's like, what is it like to live in a country where the government views every citizen as a potential enemy and feels that it's their duty to gather as much information as they can on everybody because everybody might be the enemy? And I can tell you, it is damn spooky. And it's starting to feel that way around here right now. Anyhow, go see the movie, The Lives of Others. We'll be back with your calls right after this. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Century Fox soundbite. Who gives a damn what's true or false, long as it leans to the right? At a token liberal, pretend I'm fair, a bimbo for some sex appeal. I'm busy oiling up the corporation wheel, and they call me U.S. Steel.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour on the radio support group up by and for We the People of the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. There's a blog over at AirAmerica.com or AirAmericaRadio.com, your choice. Brick in Mill Creek, Washington. Hey, Brick, what's up?
Hey, I want to ask about the Valley Parade thing from a different direction.
Sure.
And I haven't heard it on the media. Was what about Brewster Jennings? Was it a known CIA operation before the article?
No.
And isn't
the company, the company was a front company for the CIA that was involved in, apparently, I mean, it's called classified. There's very, very little information about Brewster Jennings out. But from what we've, from what I've heard from, for example, Larry Johnson, you know, CIA operative who's been on this program, has talked a little bit about it. And I don't think he's like revealing classified information, but my understanding is that Brewster Jennings was a phony front company that the CIA put together in order to go out, to go into third world countries and say, oh, you want to buy some weapons of mass destruction? We'll sell you some weapons of mass destruction. By the way, who are you? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, but was it known before Valerie Plame came out? So isn't that a bigger blowing of a CIA information?
That's right. That's right. And Valerie Plame pointed that out in her testimony.
Uh-huh.
She pointed that out in her testimony, that not only was her identity blown, but her entire network was blown, which means that people could have been killed and probably were.
Exactly.
People lost their careers and probably did. And then you look at you know, at the coverage on this thing, and I have a note here from a listener, and I'm assuming that this is sometimes that's dangerous to do, but somebody I think I can trust here, saying that ABC's report of her testimony only said, while Plame may have lost the undercover job she loved, the blown cover is allowing her to find a new career. She signed a book deal for more than $1 million. CBS, Gloria Borger, ends her report with, when asked whether she'd gotten an apology from the president and the vice president, Carl Rover, Scooter Libby, she said no. And, you know, I mean, it's like, and on NBC, Campbell Brown, you know, shows the Republican congressman asking her whether she was a Democrat and her shocking admission that she was a Democrat. I mean, and none of the networks dealt with the reality that an entire CIA counterterrorism WMD operation was brought down, at least as far as I've seen and as far as, you know, several of my listeners have. And if we've got to get over to Media Matters for America and see if, you know, if I'm assuming they've got something in more depth on that. So, but yeah, Brewster Jennings was covert. Short answer to a long, or
well, thank
long
you.
Answer to a short question. You're welcome. Yeah, thanks a lot for the call, Dan in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to mention the fact that how the Philippines, when they sort of adapted our form of democracy, so to speak, they have a two-party system, and then it's the haves and the have-nots, and that's why we need a multi-party system, to where they're, you know, the ones that are in power are the populace.
Yeah, the Philippines. I'm not all that familiar with their form of government, although I was in Manila when Ferdy Marcos fell, when his government went down. In fact, I got bumped for 4 days in a row off Philippine Airlines flights trying to get back home because he and all his buddies were fleeing to Hawaii.
Oh yeah, well, I lived in Hawaii for 15 years, and people over there, we hated that Reagan decision to bring Marcos over there.
Yeah, it was incredible. But the point is that you know how the Philippines got to be the way the Philippines is because of the Spanish-American War, you know, which back in the late 1890s in the McKinley administration, as I recall. And it must have been just before the McKinley administration, because Teddy Roosevelt fought in that war. And, you know, another phony war. You know, remember the Maine. This was a war that William Randolph Hearst said, you know, give me a war and I'll sell it for you, or words to that effect. I don't remember his exact quote, but it was something like that, because he thought it'd be good to sell newspapers.
Yeah.
And so I mean, it's like, and we fought. We still have American soldiers fighting insurgents on the remote islands in the Philippines. Here,
and a lot of
years later,
over there too, Tom.
Yeah, 100 years later, 110 years later, we still have U.S. soldiers fighting in the Philippines as a result of that crazy war. Good point, Dan. Thank you very much for calling and making it. Rob in Westchester, New York. Hey, Rob, what's on your mind?
Did you listen to the right wing on weekends? You listened to Monica Crowley by any chance?
No, I didn't.
Let me just tell you what the right wing is saying about the Attorney General's scandal. To them, there's nothing more than Bush was allowed to fire who he wants. They serve at the president's beck and call.
Right.
No, but I was trying to get on the line with her. Naturally, they don't take anybody who disagrees with her. But what I was furious about is that that's not necessarily what it's about. I mean, Gonzalez gets up and says it wasn't political. He told Congress it wasn't political. And then you have the emails, and then you have all the other proof. And then it's just and they just mislead and mislead and mislead.
Right.
And I get
here's the simple fact, Rob. The U.S. attorneys, the U.S. prosecutors, these federal prosecutors have as their job to uphold the law. The Constitution gives the power to enforce the laws made by Congress to the executive branch. In other words, the Congress makes the laws. The president makes sure that the laws are carried out, and those laws are adjudicated by the judicial branch. So here you have the three branches of government. And because the executive branch of government has within its purview making sure that the laws are enforced, you have the Department of Justice in the executive branch. It's part of the president's cabinet. And the Department of Justice has the federal prosecutors in it. And so they theoretically work for the president.
Of course.
However, they have to be approved by the Senate. I mean, the founders were very clear, the framers of the Constitution were very clear to make, very intentional to make sure that the Congress did not have the enforcement power over the laws that they themselves passed. This was part of the, separating of powers within the government so that you didn't end up with a tyranny.
Let me just interrupt. I apologize, but this is my point. At the same time, although they work for the president, they're not doing the president's dirty work. They're not used to
that.
Yeah,
that's my point. That's why you said it much, you asked me what time it was. I was trying to tell you how to make a clock, but yeah, exactly, Rob, exactly.
And
well said. In fact, I mean, the foundation, the fundamental detail of it is, yes, of course, when a new president comes into office, because all of these people work for him, it's pro forma on the political appointees who are appointed by the president but have to be confirmed by the Senate, two branches of government. And then they work in the third, their work is evaluated by the third branch of government, in other words, the judiciary. When a federal prosecutor brings a case, it has to go before a judge. So you've got all three branches of government involved here. When the president makes an appointment, once that appointment has been confirmed by the Senate, that person, you could argue that they serve at the pleasure of the president, but the fact of the matter is that the president should never meddle in what they're doing and never has. This has never happened before. And to be blowing somebody out of the water because they might investigate your vice president. I mean, this is what Nixon was doing. This is the Saturday Night Massacre. This is, just not a good thing at all. Just not a good thing at all. Lee in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Lee, what's on your mind today?
Okay. I'm a disabled veteran from Desert Storm. And one of the important things that I've been looking at is the people of the world, especially the United States, are looking to try and think about impeaching Bush, but we all know that that's going to probably take more time than it would before he's even out of office.
Yeah.
But what they're missing is something that's important that I just was thinking about is he is basically a glorified general. He's the commander-in-chief of the United States Army, Air Force, Marine Corps, whatever.
Well, yes and no, because a general is subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and the president is subject to the Constitution. There really is a huge difference. The president is a civilian.
When the commander-in-chief steps onto the battlefield, he is, in fact, the top general to give directives to any subordinate general to him.
He's not the top general.
Again?
He is not the top general.
He's the commander-in-chief, but listen to what I'm saying.
That's right. Okay.
Based on the fact that he is, we'll say, when you're in basic training, there's a wall of the chain of command. Chain of command goes from private rank all the way up to President of the United States. It's very clearly identified to every military individual as they go through their training to recognize chain of command and the responsibilities that go with it. What I'm saying is, there needs to be an evaluation into the military side of what the president represents. Yes, he is the head of the executive branch,
You're suggesting, in essence, that we should relieve him of his command of the military.
Relieve him for cause. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, see the problem is that there's no civilian equivalent of that. And he is not subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, to the UCMJ, which is what you would have to invoke in order to relieve him of command. Let me correct myself, Lee. There is a very specific constitutional remedy. It's called impeachment.
Right.
That is relieving the president of his command duties.
Point. Okay. It could be, we'll say, a senator or a congressman. When I was running my explosives demolitions range, and a congressman comes out, or a senator, or a statesman of some kind that was not wearing a military uniform.
Right.
If that individual had with them a cell phone or even so much as an electronic watch, I would give them a directive that they needed to shut that off because of the danger that it involved on my range.
Right, because you controlled the military field. Yeah.
Well, listen.
Hang on for just a second, Lee. We got to take a break. I'll pick it up on the other side. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Call me U.S. Steel. 21st Century Fox soundbite. Who gives a damn what's true or false? Long as it leans to the right. Add a token liberal, pretend I'm fair.
Yeah, I think we've heard this one before. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Lee in Vancouver. You were just pointing out that if a congressperson, a member of Congress, is on your battlefield and you're a commander,
right,
that you have the power to tell them to turn off their watch.
Right.
Are you sure you have the legal power, or do you think that they are simply accommodating you?
Well, it can be enforced, and I was referring to an explosives range. And there were, in fact, individuals in towers with loaded rifles watching for a safety issue to take place. If the command was given by the ranking NCO or officer on that range that a safety situation took place, it was point, shoot, to kill. Now, I'm not.
And this was inside the United States or outside the United
States?
States?
This is not what I'm saying.
No, no, but Lee, was this inside the United States or outside the United
States?
This
was outside the United States. It was actually in Hohenfels, Germany.
Yeah, see,
it took place during Saudi Arabia as well as.
Yeah,
but it also
again, I'm not a JAG officer, but it may, or any kind of lawyer for that matter, but it may well be that outside the United States they are subject to basically your law. You know,
well,
the civilians.
Belmore, Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, anywhere in the United States as well.
Yeah.
The point is situation.
One last point.
The point being the fact that at what point would the megalomania have to be, and or ask a senator or congressman, if you get them on this show, have them say an exact number. How many people do they need to see marching peacefully to the House of Representatives and to Congress to say, it is time now?
Yeah.
Do they need to see?
Lee, the answer to that question is pretty straightforward. It's going to be different for every member of Congress, and it's going to be an equation that is comprised of how many of those people are from their district, how many of those people are, you know, in their base, how many of those people does it take to balance the weight of the lobbyists that they're talking to. I mean, there's a whole, unfortunately, a whole bunch of variables in that. But your point is well taken, and I appreciate it, and thank you for your passion in making it and for your concern in calling. Ellen Ratner's on the line with us with Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Today was a very interesting Supreme Court case. I unfortunately was not there, but one of our staffers was. This has to do with the Morris versus Frederick case, the Bong for Jesus banner that was during an Olympic torch relay that took place in Juneau, Alaska. The school
right, Bong hits for Jesus.
Right,
as I recall.
I guess yeah. So, exactly. Something like that. But it didn't say, as Justice not Stevens, I guess, Ruth Bader Ginsburg said it did not say smoke pot, legalize marijuana. But in any case, the person that was representing the school system was none other than Mr. Kenneth Starr. And essentially, their argument is that the sign advocated drug use, that this kid was suspended for 10 days. The kid argued that he was suspended for 5 days, but when he brought up the issue of the Bill of Rights, he was suspended for 10 days. Interesting, the court took up the Tinker versus Des Moines case that is famous because that's when during the Vietnam War the students wore black armbands. And right. That was considered a free speech issue. And the Kenneth Starr said this was blatant promotion of the use of illegal drugs, that schools must teach values, that this is what's important in society, and this wasn't about free speech, it was about drugs. The lawyer that was arguing at the Supreme Court for the students says it wasn't about drugs, it was not a school-sponsored event. And in fact, several students had signed affidavits saying they were told that they were released from school for this particular Olympic torch rally. And Judge Souter said this was a sign of free speech, or he asked a question to that effect. Justice right. Stevens said something about educational missions are also subject to congressional challenges. Not constitutional challenges.
Interesting.
Kind of interesting.
So these were just the arguments that were made today.
Just the arguments. We do not have a decision from the Supreme Court, but I think it's a pretty right. interesting. I don't know if you remember when we were growing up, Thomas Sowers, who wrote The Myth of Mental Illness, said, you know, prison, the childhood is a prison of 21 years. Well, this has to really to do right. with the students who are under 18 or who are 18 or in a school system have free speech rights. That's right. always been an interesting question.
Yeah.
The other thing that happened today is that during the morning gaggle this morning, that is the part of the White House briefing that is not on camera, Tony Snow said zip it to CNN reporter Ed Henry. Ed Henry said it's not appropriate to respond like that. Tony actually apologized. But I think mm-hmm. it speaks to what kind of pressure Tony Snow must be on, because he is usually the coolest cucumber on this planet.
Yeah, this White House is melting down right now. And now comes out this story. I don't know if you've seen the Think Progress blog, thinkprogress.org. Carol Lam, you know, the attorney fired in California.
That's right.
The federal contractor who paid $140,000 for Duke Cunningham's boat 2 weeks earlier had received exactly $140,000. The week that the price of the boat was negotiated, by the way. It was negotiated before he went out and bought it with Duke. 2 weeks earlier had been given $140,000 by guess who? Dick Cheney. You still there?
The world gets smaller and smaller. And I got to say, I know this is whatever, but I do feel bad for Tony Snow.
Yeah, indeed. But this Carol Lam might have been looking at the White House. This is amazing stuff. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen,
for the report
from Washington. Great talking with you. Coming up tomorrow, Ross Gelbspan is going to be here to expose the great global warming swindle. Conservative Larry Platt says politicians and conservatives can now shoot back. I mean, literally. And Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress dropping by. That and more in your calls. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.